The book of Philippians, chapter 2. Well, you might remember a time in your life where you did something for somebody, not because you wanted the reward, not because of the payment, but because you loved that person. It was a labor of love. For example, we only had one big snowstorm, and it came at the tail end of the season, you might remember. But it was enough to dump about 16 inches of snow, and my driveway was buried. And so I was out there with my snow shovel looking at all I had to do, and I have a long driveway. Well, the neighbor across the street saw me and grabbed another guy, and the two of them brought their snow blowers over to my house, and within 30 minutes, they had me clear. Now, I'll say that they didn't benefit from that at all. That was nothing for them. That was a labor of love. Ever since we've been married, my wife has wanted some kind of a fruit tree or a fruit bush, but up until now, we really haven't had the opportunity to do that. But we do now. And so over the last couple of years, every birthday, every Mother's Day, we've planted a peach tree or we've planted some kind of bush. This year it was blueberries, something so that we could have some fruit. Well, this year was the first time we actually got any peaches off of those trees we planted last year. And I'll tell you, when we got them, to be perfectly honest, they were the sorriest peaches I have ever seen. They were about the size of a golf ball. And if you bought these things at the store, you'd probably take them back and want a refund. They were that small. But they ripened, they tasted fine, and if you ask my wife, they were some of the most delicious peaches we ever had. I didn't plant those trees for those peaches. I planted those trees for my wife. That was a labor of love. Or think about the time Jesus was with his disciples. And they were in the upper room. They were participating in the event we would later call the Last Supper or Communion, which we're going to remember here in just a little while. But it tells us that he surprised the entire group when he stood up and he took off his outer garment, his robe, and he put on the apron of a slave, and he got down on his hands and his knees, and he washed their feet. You remember what he said to them after? He said in John 13, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you, you are to love one another." And then they got up from that meal, and they left that upper room, and they're walking through the streets of Jerusalem on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus would be arrested. And he would be taken from there, he would be taken to different trials, different tribunals, eventually to the cross. But on the way, on that journey, he took an opportunity and he told them in John 15, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." You see, Jesus' entire life was a labor of love. When he came to earth, when he was born into the human race, when he said he would take away the sins of the world, when he died on the cross, when he descended into the grave, when he rose in victory, none of that was for him. All of that was for us. All of that was a labor of love. It was something done for someone else. And as we come to our passage this morning, that's the idea Paul has in mind. That's his inspiration in this writing. Notice he says at the very beginning of our passage in verse 12, he starts by writing, "Therefore." In other words, because of everything he's just said, and you'll recall what he just said from last week, we looked at it in verse 5 of this chapter. He said, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by being obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." And so Paul says, because of that, because of Jesus' sacrifice, and because of the labor of love that he showed us, and because of the example that he set, because of that, he writes, "Therefore." You see, everything he's about to tell us to do is based on what Jesus has already done. And everything Jesus did was a labor of love. And because he calls us to love one another as he loved us first, we're called to a labor of love as well. And that's what we want to look at this morning as we look at verse 12 of chapter 2. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Last week, I went outside and I mowed the grass. I did it. And it takes a couple of hours, but after cutting the grass, I get the weed eater and I go around the house and I trim around the garden and around all that other stuff, the fire pit that we have. And by the time that chore was done, my shoes were absolutely filthy. I mean, covered in grass, covered in mud, covered in dirt. They were so dirty, I couldn't wear them the rest of the week. Inside and out, nothing but grass. Well, I came home on Thursday to find those same shoes were no longer sitting out on the porch covered in grass, but were now sitting in the living room. The laces had been pulled out, and my wife had run those through the washer, and they had come out clean, and they were just sitting there waiting to dry. None of that was for her. She didn't benefit from my shoes being clean. She has her own shoes. She has a lot of shoes. I have one pair. I was in a bind. But it was a labor of love. And as believers, we're called to live that way. We are called to labor in love for others. But especially to labor in love for Christ. Because when you do that, you stand out. You're different from the rest of the world. Do you remember when Jesus washed those disciples' feet and he said, love each other the same way I've just loved you? The very next statement he made was, by this all people will know you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And it's interesting because throughout the Bible we get this idea, this reoccurring theme that love is a verb. In other words, love is an action. Love is something we do. Love is something we show. Jesus said in John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Not if you keep my commandments, you'll be saved, but a person who is saved and is in love with Christ will naturally want to show that through obedience. You see, love is much more than just a feeling, but rather an action, a labor of love. Because here's the thing. When a person is so filled with the joy of Christ, that joy comes out. And one of the ways we looked at last week that joy comes out is through humility, through putting other people first. But another way it comes out is through service, by how we treat other people, by how we react to other people. And if you remember from last week, we redefined the word service, didn't we? We said that it's not something we do for someone out of the kindness of our heart, but rather God's grace moving through our life into the people around us. And this week, we want to see exactly what that looks like. What does it mean to labor in love? And one of the first things we notice from this passage is that we labor in the development of a relationship with God. We labor in the development of a relationship with God. Notice what Paul says at the very end of verse 12. He says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. When I was growing up, I remember my brother and I had very different relationships with our parents. I was closer to my dad. We were interested in history and art and baseball and construction and woodworking and that kind of thing and airplanes. My brother, on the other hand, was very close to our mother. She was a nurse. He later became a paramedic. They both have a passion for music. They both have an empathy for other people. And so each one of us had a very different relationship with our parents, even though our parents both loved each one of us the same. And the same is true with God. Every person is loved by the Lord. Every person is loved equally by the Lord, but every person does have a very different relationship with the Lord. Your relationship with God will be different than someone else's, and theirs will be different from someone else yet. In the book of Jeremiah, it says in chapter 29, "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. Plans for good, not for evil, for a future, for a hope." God has a very special plan for each person's life. You might remember David from the Old Testament, King David, David and Goliath, that David. Well, God loved David. God loved David incredibly, and so much so that God said, "David, I'm going to make a commitment to you. This is my covenant to you. No matter whatever happens, no one will sit on the throne of Israel if they don't come from your line. That's how much I love you, David." And David said, "Well, Lord, I love you. And later on, I want to build a temple to your name." But remember what God said to David about that temple in 1 Chronicles 28. He says, "God told me you may not build a house for my name. You are a man of war. He said to me, 'It is Solomon, your son, who shall build my house. I have chosen him.'" You see, God loved David, and God loved Solomon. And God loved David and Solomon the same, but God loved David and Solomon differently. And God's love and plan for David's life was very different than his plan for Solomon's life. And God's relationship with you will be different than his relationship with me, and that will be different from his relationship with anyone else. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 12, having gifts that differ according to the grace we've been given. And so here he says to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You know, one of the greatest parts of having a relationship with the Lord is discovering the plans he has for your life, to see what it is he has in store. There is no downtime when it comes to the Lord. There's no time where we're just wondering, "Boy, this is boring." Every single moment with God is a new discovery. I like what Solomon would later write in Proverbs 25. "It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings to search them out." And so we're searching for his will, and we're discovering his will. And Paul says to work out that salvation with fear and trembling. And so on an individual level, each one of us has a different relationship with God. Each one of us is laboring in the development of that relationship. We're working on it. We're discovering it. It might surprise you to hear the same is true for churches. Each church has a different calling and a different relationship with the Lord. Remember, Paul isn't just writing to one person here. He's writing to the church at Philippi, the Philippian church. And since this letter is instructional in nature, the argument is made that it's not just for the Philippian church, but rather all the churches. And so Paul is writing a letter to every single church that would ever live. And part of that message is that God has a plan for that church. He has a plan for the Philippians. He has a plan for everyone. And he has a unique calling for each one that he builds. You remember back to the book of Numbers when God was about to send Israel into battle. And he said, "You need to take a census of your population to know how many men you have to go fight this war. But if you remember," he said, "do not take a census of the tribe of Levi. They've got a different purpose. They've got a different calling." He tells us in Numbers chapter 1, "Only the tribe of Levi you should not list and should not take a census of them, but appoint them over the tabernacle." You see, God had a very different plan for one group than he had for another. And he has a different plan for one church than he has for another. And it's up to those churches, it's up to the congregations, it's up to the bodies of believers to discover what that is. And what that means for us here at Shepherd is this. We're not called to be the church down the road. We're not called to do what they do. We're not called to try and be like they are. They have a calling. They have a job, and only they can do that. But likewise, we have a calling, and we have a job, and they can't do ours. One of the fastest ways for any person to find themselves outside of the will of God for their life is to try and copy the will of God for someone else's life. And so Paul says here, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Labor in the development of the relationship with God, personally, corporately as a church. Secondly, we labor in the contentment of life. Look at verse 14. He says, do all things without grumbling or disputing. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. You ever met a person that grumbles about everything? They don't like their job. They hate their boss. They hate the weather. It's too hot. It's too cold. It's too dark. It's too light. It's too early in the year. It's too late in the year. It's too early to get up. They slept the day away. And what you start to see and you get a picture of is a person that just resents life, right? I mean, everything in life there's some complaint about. The world is full of that. The world is full of resenters. And that's exactly what Paul is talking about. Because the Greek word for grumble literally means to resent. It means to have bitterness in your heart about doing something it is that you're doing. I remember when I was working for the window company I worked for some time, I got back to the shop and it was at the end of the day and my manager came to me and said, I need you to go out and help Fred because Fred is on this job and he's been on it all day and it's taking him longer to finish than it should have and he's nowhere near done and he needs help. And as soon as I heard that, what I knew that meant was I was going home late. Fred needed help. It was the end of the day. This was going to be overtime. I wasn't keen on working overtime there. And so all the way over, I resented being there. I got to the job site. My first statement to poor Fred was, "What is it you couldn't get done on time?" I grumbled. I resented the fact that I was there. I had to apologize, and fortunately, he forgave me, and we finished the job. But Paul says, don't do that. He says, don't grumble, don't resent. Or think about the parable of the workers in the vineyard that Jesus taught. And he told us that there were workers waiting for work, and a master of a vineyard shows up and says, I'll pay you a denarius, or a standard day's wage, if you come and work in my vineyard. And they agreed. But you will remember that halfway through the day, the master hired more people for the same wage, and the first employees figured out they were getting paid less per hour than the others. And it says in Matthew chapter 20, and on receiving it, when they got their pay, it says, they grumbled at their master. Paul says, don't do that. Don't grumble. Don't resent. In Ephesians 6, it says, rendering service with goodwill as to the Lord and not man. You see, it can't be a labor of love if we grumble the whole time. It can't be a labor of love if we resent the fact that we're doing it. All that does is turn someone else's blessing into your burden. And nobody wants to be the cause of someone's burden. And so Paul says here, do all things without grumbling. But notice what else he says. He says, or disputing. Now, if grumbling deals with the attitude of the heart, the resentment in the heart towards something we're doing, disputing deals with the attitude of the mind. And the two go hand in hand. And the reason for that is disputing literally means plotting or calculating. And here's how it works. I resent that I've been told by my manager to go help my coworker. And so on the way over there, I'm thinking, boy, if he just would have done his job, if he would have gotten there a little earlier, I wouldn't be inconvenienced and I wouldn't have to be doing that. And I'm plotting and I'm calculating all the reasons that I resent what it is I'm doing. Paul says, don't do that. Don't dispute. Don't grumble. He says, do all things without grumbling, without disputing. And with some things, that's easy. When it's a higher purpose, when I'm planting a tree for my wife, it's easy to do that without grumbling, without disputing. I'm enjoying the labor. But what about when it's 3 a.m.? And if you're a pet owner, you'll recognize this scene. It's 3 a.m. and you've been awoken by your dog to the sound of hacking in the corner. But again, it's 3 a.m. and you're not quite with it. So by the time you realize what's going on, it's too late. And now it's 3:15 a.m. and you are on your hands and knees with paper towels and cleaner, scrubbing the carpet in your bedroom, and then comes that familiar lingering odor. And you know that your whole evening is just shot, you're not getting back to bed, and your dog is sitting there looking at you like, what's the big deal? Certainly we could complain about that. Certainly that warrants some grumbling. But Paul says, do all things without grumbling. And here's why. When you do all things without grumbling, without disputing, without resentment, without plotting and calculating, when you do that, you stand out from the world. Notice what he says at the end of verse 15, that you shine as lights in the world. You see, the world is naturally a complaining world. It is a discontented world. I read a statistic this past week that said 50%, half of all people surveyed, admitted they hated their state and they would move to another one if given the chance. Half of all people were discontent with where they were living. That's the world. That's the world's approach to life. And when you're different from that, when you don't have that approach to life, you stand out like a light in the middle of a dark room. And people get to see how the joy of Christ in your life affects how you live. I like what Paul said when he ended this letter in chapter 4, verse 11. He says, not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's contentment. That's doing all things without grumbling. That's doing all things without disputing. That is an evangelistic tool. And when you use it, you shine the light for Christ into the world around you. So we labor in love by developing our relationship with God. We're searching, we're working out His plans that He has for our life. We labor in the contentment of life itself. We do all things without grumbling, without disputing. And finally, as we close, we labor in the commitment to our faith. Notice what he says in verse 16, holding fast to the word of life. Holding fast to the word of life. In 1812, there was an American missionary by the name of Adoniram Judson, and he went to Burma, where he spent the next 38 years as a missionary before he died. Well, in those 38 years in Burma, Adoniram Judson was arrested, he was tortured, he was beaten, he was thrown in jail, he was mocked, he was scoffed at, he was teased, he was abused, he was tortured, and the list goes on. But somehow, Adoniram Judson was able to translate the Bible into the Burmese language. Now, when he died in 1850, Burma had less than 25 believers. After he died, the church exploded, and now there are more than 600,000. One of those believers was quoted as saying this, "We know him. We know how he loved the Burmese people, how he suffered for the gospel because of us, out of love for us. He died a pauper, but left the Bible for us. When he died, there were few of us, but today there are over 600,000 of us. And every single one of us traces our spiritual heritage to one man, the Reverend Adoniram Judson." Judson planted the seeds that created a church that was absolutely committed to their faith. And that's what Paul wants for the church at Philippi. He wants to know that even if he dies, which is a real possibility, remember, he's writing this from prison. He's sitting in Rome in a jail cell waiting to see Caesar because he's appealing his case, his arrest case, all the way to Caesar in Rome, as was his right as a citizen. But he doesn't know what Caesar's going to do. Caesar could say, "You're an annoyance," and chop off his head. Paul has no idea what's coming. And he says, even if he dies, he wants to know that the Philippian church will remain faithful. Notice he says in verse 16, holding fast. You know, in Greek, that word is apeko, and it means to stay put. It means to stop where you are, to not be moved. And he says, don't be moved. Stop where you are. Stay put. Hold fast to the word. Remain faithful. Hold on to your faith. Keep in mind, this is a young church. And ever since he's been arrested, this church has been freaking out. And they've been arguing, and they've been disputing, and they've been bickering, and they've been dividing. And so Paul says, look, even if I'm gone, if I'm poured out as an offering, even if I die, I need you to remain faithful. I need you to hold fast in your faith. Paul hopes that those seeds will produce a church dedicated, committed to their faith. And it might surprise you to hear, or maybe it won't surprise you to hear, that is the hardest thing for a believer to do. To remain faithful in the midst of a world trying to pull you away. Because it requires a lifetime of endurance. It requires a lifetime of commitment every single day. A recommitment to your faith and to the Lord. Paul said in 2 Timothy 4, I have fought the good fight. I finished the race. I kept the faith. It's a hard thing to do to keep your faith. Because as much as you're holding on, the world is pulling you away. And it's tugging, and it's pulling, and it's trying to drag you away from the word of life. I read something this week that absolutely blew my mind. When the Puritans settled this nation hundreds of years ago, they were the first ones to develop a public school system. But according to the charter of the very first public school, now remember, public school, the mission was to teach the faith to their children. It further surprised me to learn that of all of the big name colleges on the Eastern Seaboard, places like Harvard and Yale and Duke and Princeton, even the University of Pennsylvania itself, these were started as Bible colleges. They were started as seminaries. And of our founding fathers, the vast majority of them were seminary educated. They went to Bible college. They had those degrees. That's where we started. But over the years, the world has pulled. And the world has tugged. And the world has dragged. And now we are at a point where, according to one Barna survey, and I don't know if you know who Barna is, but they do a lot of surveys for the church and that sort of thing. But according to Barna, a recent survey concluded half of pastors, now these are guys behind pulpits, these are guys preaching on Sunday, half of pastors denied one or more of the following. The Bible is accurate. Jesus was sinless, Satan is real, God is omnipotent, salvation is by grace alone, and we are given the responsibility to share our faith. Half of pastors denied one of those things. Make no mistake about it, commitment to your faith is a labor. Commitment to your faith is a hard task. It is a deliberate effort. But at the same time, every day you commit yourself to your faith, and every day you hold fast to the word, like Paul writes, you also make a statement that says, no matter what goes on in the world around me, I will not give up on the God that did not give up on me. That's a labor of love. It's all about the one being served and not the person doing the serving. And so I would encourage you this week, wherever you are, wherever you find yourself, at work or school or in the grocery store, at the gas station, or whatever it may be, to find a way to be that light, to stand out from the crowd and to labor in love for the Lord.